I am here to talk to you about some work we've done to sort of look into the minds of poll workers. This is joint work sponsored by the NSF Accurate Grant. Accurate's done, but this was started in 2010, so there's a lag in publication, obviously. I led this work along with Professor Coy Cheshire and Deirdre Mulligan of the UC Berkeley School of Information with our graduate students Emily Barabas and Gregory Shapiro. Quick outline, I'm going to tell you why we wanted to do this, how we did this, what we learned from it, and some sort of lessons we took away from this whole endeavor, and some recommendations, sort of tentative recommendations for things we found. So the motivation here is that, at least in the U.S., I don't have a lot of information. One of the liabilities of working on elections in the U.S. is you don't tend to work on elections in other places so much. But in the U.S., at least, if you're voting inside the polling place, poll workers are literally the front line. They are the interface between the voter and the rest of the election system. Their actions decide how your vote makes it to the election headquarters and gets counted or not. There has been a lot of scrutiny of the security and privacy properties of these machines and of the processes involved with making sure votes actually get counted properly. But there's only been a little bit of work on poll workers. A lot of it is from the political science tradition, so survey work. And some of this stuff finds that that training is important if you want elections to be run very well. Unfortunately, not everyone is trained. In California, for example, something there's been a few surveys that show in a number of different counties that something like 20 to 30% of people have never gone to a poll worker training class. And so they're literally learning on the job, which is unfortunate, especially based on what we see here in a little bit. Another thing is that, you know, voter confidence and sort of the trustworthiness of an election process is really sort of mediated by their perceptions of what the poll workers are doing and whether or not the poll workers are sort of mentally out to lunch and stuff like that, or if they make mistakes, even if they do seem to be all there. And as a lot of us have found in various investigations, a lot of which is published here at this conference, that the integrity of voting systems and the processes are really depend on what poll workers do. That if you make one small mistake, it can totally undermine elections. And I have some examples I can show you. The methodology we did here, I mean, the goal, right, was to sort of try and pull out of the brains of these voters how they think about security and privacy in the polling place. So what are sort of their mental models? What are aspects of their mental models? We can't say we do that perfectly. I don't know if anyone, you can't do brain core dumps yet, but that would be really neat. I would have work for many years, and a lot of us would, psychologists would as well. What we did is a two-part qualitative methodology, and I'll talk a little more about this in a bit, but in short, we observed privacy and security issues in an election in November of 2010. And then months later, we interviewed poll workers that we observed about some of those things. Not necessarily, hey, we saw you do this, but more, how would you react to this stuff? I'll talk about that in a sec. Based on the reviews our paper got, I really need to talk to you guys about qualitative methods. It's clear our reviewers, some of them, don't understand the value of qualitative methods. Qualitative methods are not about measuring, the extent of things, how prevalent something is. It's really, it's not about testing hypotheses, it's really about discovering hypotheses that you may want to test later with quantitative methods or with whatever you want to do. We don't find generalizable findings, it's about discovery. It's like, oh, we saw that, oh, we saw this. It's not we saw X of those, we saw Y of those, or we saw that over this period of time. It rarely results in what we would say are generalizable findings. It's more like, look, here's a place to look for more interesting stuff, but it is, it does help us know where to look further. So more deeply into our methodology here, in terms of the observations, we wanted to sort of try and get the widest range of, am I standing in the right place? Sorry, okay. We wanted to try and get the widest range. So, what do we see that's going well? What are some of the things that we see in these polling places that are clearly problematic from a point of view of security and privacy issues? We observed four polling places over an entire day in a general election in a county that I cannot mention for various concerns. Feel free to ask me a question about that if you want to hear more about that. And since we wanted to sort of bracket the observations and see, as much as we could, we wanted to pick polling place environments that were as different as we possibly could find. And our proxy, which it doesn't have to be very robust, was two high socioeconomical status polling places and two low socioeconomical status polling places. The high ones tended to be more racially less diverse, tended to be less racially diverse, and the lower ones tended to have a lot more racial diversity in this particular county. We spent about 2 hours at each. One place we only spent about an hour and a half at. That's all in the paper. And our observers, the graduate students, myself, and another individual, were specifically primed and trained to look for issues related to security and privacy. Then, about 8 months later, I believe that's correct, we sent recruitment letters to about 70 poll workers, so the ones from the four polling places we observed and four other polling places that were similar, so that we could capture stuff that we may not have actually observed, but we would get in the interview process. The interview process involved priming the interviewees. This is a standard technique. It's hard to remember stuff that happened 8 years later, so you get them talking about their election experience and sort of like, yeah, I remember that, yeah. Then we led them through 10 vignettes, so little scenarios that were built around things we had observed in the original observations, and then sort of asked them, what would you do? What do you think about this? What are sort of the risks? What's the worst case scenario in these in this kind of a situation? And finally, we had more general questions, more open-ended security and privacy questions, so they could tell us stuff that we may not have asked about, but it may have jogged their memory during the vignette part. Okay, so into the findings specifically, one of the most surprising things is we observed four polling places, and in each polling place they had very different what we call leadership models. And what we mean by that is some structured way of approaching decision making and directing the actions in the polling place. The first place was a hierarchy, so kind of like a military kind of, there were clear lines of communication, and there was a chief poll inspector and some deputy poll inspectors and a whole bunch of clerks. But it was micromanaged in that the chief polling inspector would tell people to do something and then watch them do it and redo it if they did it wrong. In the second site, I call it anarchy, but that's sort of just a fun thing to say because there was no recognizable order whatsoever in this polling place. And we'll see how that became problematic in a little bit. The third place was also a hierarchy, but it was more delegated. The chief polling inspector would say, here's your job, go do it, and wouldn't sort of follow up and watch them. They would check it later and correct things that went wrong, but they really sort of allowed the polling places, the workers under them, much more autonomy. The last place was this strange sort of co-op. It was kind of like this, you know, I don't know how to say it without sounding, I don't know, it's sort of this very strange, no one clearly had the point of leadership, but there were people that clearly knew more about elections and others that didn't, and everyone was sort of equal for whatever reason, despite their titles, in terms of authority and power. And sort of specifically to security and privacy issues, we saw in the second sort of anarchic or whatever you want to call it, lack of power vacuum kind of a place, we saw the chief polling inspector standing by. This isn't the actual voting machine. If I show you the voting machine, there's a good chance you could guess what county this is, and I don't want you to be able to do that. But we saw him standing by this scanner like this, with his hands like this, and this door right there was wide open with a bunch of ballots sticking out. And they're vote-by-mail ballots. They're in envelopes. But this is still not how things are done at all, right? I mean, you want to have chain of custody. You want to make sure that things, secured assets are locked with a lock and key. And we didn't add, this is participant observation, so you try your best not to get involved, although I'll show you a case in which we did and actually messed things up. But here, as far as we can tell, it was getting clogged, so people would come in with a vote-by-mail ballot that they wanted to put in the slot, and it would get clogged, and someone had to unlock it and unclog it periodically. And this guy just got tired of doing that, so left the key in the lock with the thing open, exposed to everyone, and that was clearly a problem. And when he came over to talk to us and said things, he had this idea about creating a Latino AARP that he really wanted to talk to us about. I don't know why. But when he came and talked to us about this, another poll worker would walk up to the optical scanner, shut it, lock it, and put the key around his wrist, which is the proper procedure in California. You have two keys for the scanners on both wrists whenever you're there, and would walk away. And when this guy noticed that, he'd walk over, get the key back, and open it back up, which is kind of unfortunate. I think this timing isn't going to work right. Oh, it works right. Fine. Okay. We also saw in the last sort of, I want to use the word hippy-dippy, but that's not the right word. It was really sort of like this co-op kind of a place. The last site, they actually left the scanner head. So this top of the scanner actually detaches, and you're supposed to deliver that in this county with your materials. They left that at the polling place. And if you know anything about scanners and vulnerabilities in scanners, leaving a scanner head unexposed for about 60 minutes with no one around it that's not good. I mean, there's no evidence that anyone did anything to it, but at the same time, it's clearly a something that should not happen in the future. That auxiliary bin tended to overflow, and that thing I showed you with a little hole in it, and the proper procedure in this county is they have a soft-sided ballot box, so it comes flat, and I wish I had a picture of it, I don't, but it's this blue thing, you set it up, and it's this soft-sided ballot box that you then seal with a tamper-evident seal, and then you insert ballots one by one into the box. It's sort of like, if you run out of room, here's another box for you to put stuff in. Unfortunately, people just don't seem to understand tamper seals very well, and in one case, this is the kind of seal on the box, and so it's this part right here levers down, and then you stick a white tab into this, and then if you try and open the lock, the latch, it will break, and you can't do anything about it, and you've broken your tamper-evident seal. Unfortunately, in one case, in the first site, they actually asked us for help, and they said, hey, we can't seem to get this thing to stick in there or whatever, can you please help us? And we're like, okay, we're reluctant to intervene, but whatever, we'll help you. And I accept this full responsibility, totally broke the seal trying to set it up. As far as I know, the instructions were wrong from the county, but I may have just misplaced them or transposed a couple different ones. And interestingly enough, the poll inspector's solution to this was to use about half a roll of duct tape over the tamper tape and just, you know, really do it and make sure no one could get into it, which is a really neat solution because if you think about it, it provides some notion of tamper evidence, unless you have a whole bunch of duct tape on you. But at the same time, the time it's going to take for you to break into that ballot box has been significantly increased. There was a number of instances of photography where people asked if they could take a picture in the polling place, and in all cases, the polling officials, the poll workers said, no, that's not appropriate. You can't do that. However, we saw a lot of smartphone usage, and in California, many counties have signs that say no cell phones all over the polling place. And I'm not sure, that's not in the law anywhere. I know California election law, like the back of my hand, it's not in the law, so I don't know where that comes from. I think it might just be a distraction thing. But people would sit down and sit there and surf the web to try and fill in initiatives because they hadn't done their homework beforehand. And in a couple cases, they were very vocal, you know, oh, I don't agree with that, like sitting there talking their way through this stuff. It was really strange, and there was no effort to curb that. One official actually said, oh, this is their cheat sheet. It's not going to harm anyone. And then we had a couple of cases of poll workers when there was an error and the ballot would be stuck back out. They would actually look at the marked face of the ballot to figure out what was wrong without asking permission or anything like that. Then in the interviews, so we set up these vignettes, these 10 vignettes that had things like, a voter's ballot is rejected, what do you do? And then we ask them, you know, do you look at the ballot? Do you ask them permission and stuff like that? The vignettes are included in the appendix of the paper if you want to look at those. But some of the findings here, it's clear that voters don't really sort of have this intuitive feeling for security issues and security properties and security relevant procedures. The only one case that's an exception is the two-person rule, that you need to have two people carrying sensitive assets someplace so that if one tries to do something, the other can serve as a check and balance against them. They don't understand why we seal. They don't understand tamper seals. In a couple of cases, they had thought that this was a protective seal from the manufacturer, and they should just rip them off because, you know, it's in use now. It's sort of like that thin film on some of the devices you get these days. It's a protective film. They thought it was that and not something that had a different functions. They definitely don't see the scanner. No one mentioned the scanner as something that is needed protection. A couple of people said specifically, oh, that just counts numbers. We have the paper ballots. That's not a problem. Yeah, that's true, and I'm glad that they understand that. But at the same time, there is an important part of keeping the scanner head, you know, secure and without significant tampering. What else? Whenever you talk to people about security, they think of that as physical safety. So they think of people running in the polling into the site and shooting people or stealing stuff. Like, you know, someone stole my cell phone last time is something they said. It's like, wow, okay. A lot of the lower workers who've been doing it for a long time and collecting a paycheck don't think that because they've been there longer that there's no chain of command, that they can do anything they want, and that's rather unfortunate. And that we did see some of this ad hoc kind of modifications to procedures, either taping up a seal or in some cases people created their own flow charts, like they thought the procedures were too complicated so they made their own. And in a couple cases there was clear errors in these homemade charts that they had made, and I'm like, that's great that you're doing that. It would be nice maybe if election officials created things that were more usable than the standard stuff, although I've seen election officials do really wonderful things. And in terms of privacy, people have a much more intuitive grasp of privacy. You know, they tend to recognize when someone's looking over your shoulder while you're filling out a ballot. That's the problem. You know, they just understand privacy better, I guess. In a couple cases with looking at the marked ballot faces, you know, it seemed like the poll workers had this desire to, help sort of trumped their notions of privacy. That, for whatever reason, they weren't thinking of all these competing things in their head, and they really just wanted to help. The perceptions of photography, everyone's pretty much uniformly said, no way, no one could take photos in the polling place. In fact, we've had people come in, one person said, there were candidates, and we shut down the polling place so that no one's actually doing anything that could be considered, you know, sensitive. And then smartphones, people were sort of, a number of poll workers said, yeah, there's no cell phones, like as if they knew that rule, and that's an easy black and line rule, and that's fine. But others were like, look, you know, they're not holding up the line, what's wrong with them, you know, doing a little bit of research and becoming more informed while they're there. So some conclusions to take away from this. You know, I think, you know, it seems like security is a more distributive value. They don't experience attacks or things that would otherwise, you know, make them think about security on a regular basis in an election environment. You know, and I should say, you know, I talk about a lot of bad things that happen here, but most of the observations, many people in this room would be quite bored sitting there doing what we did because it was really uneventful, and these little things we saw were really like one or two things over a two-hour period or something like that, despite the magnitude in some cases. I think privacy is more experienced, it seems to be more experienced as an individual value, and they often have problems with, you know, they often have people complain that, hey, there's no, you know, I would like to fill out my ballot, I have to go over to this table, but there's no, you know, booth there for me to do it. I will wait for the actual booth to become available. And so I think people actually experience that more often. Smartphones clearly are becoming reference tools. I think that's, what was that? I think that smartphones, it's kind of this weird double-edged sword in the sense that, you know, I have one, I have this tracking device in my pocket, and it's very useful as a reference tool. And in fact, three counties in California, Marin, Santa Cruz, and San Bernardino, have an official voter guide app that they will be running this fall that will store your choices on your ballot on your phone, and so you can pull it up when you're in the actual voting booth and fill it out correctly. There are a number of problems. If you know anything about mobile app security, I would never mark a ballot on my phone, but you know, this is something that, you know, I don't think we've thought about this a lot. And this is just speculation on the behalf of us as authors, but it seems like, whereas, you know, cybersecurity values are something that are sort of so new that people aren't familiar with, that we're so far from the time in which coercion and vote buying was a problem that people don't really see these forms of undue influence being a problem with votes, that you could actually be colluding with someone over a phone. It sounds really easy. I like the idea of people being able to think of on their feet about how to solve a problem. It's a security or privacy related problem, taping up something, creating a flow chart, whatever the heck it is. I don't know how we actually train people to do that right without creating other problems. Maybe it's better just to let them, give them things to, you know, a script. In terms of leadership models, I got about 20 seconds. We saw four different models in four places, which leads me to believe that if we looked at more places, we'd see more different models. And it was sort of correlated with security and privacy issues in the sense that the anarchic place is where we saw a lot of problems. Let's see. I think that the hierarchical model controls and centralizes risk, but if you're going to micromanage things, I think that undermines the trust within the team. And so it would be neat to have election officials teach people about team dynamics and say how, you know, talk about delegated trust and things like that. The cooperative model in the last place seemed really promising because it was this, you know, everyone loved it. The voters loved it, the poll workers loved it, but it had all these problems. They left the scanner head back at the polling place. At the end of the day, you put an ender card. I think that just gave away the model of the voting system. Anyway, you put an ender card in the voting system to shut the election down. They couldn't get it to go. Well, it turns out they had a piece of lasagna stuck on the ballot. And it wouldn't fit in the scanner. And the problem there is that, you know, they had this potluck that the poll workers brought for everybody and the voters. And it's great. It's this great social atmosphere. But there's little small things like that. And that's just one good example that sort of undermines things that happen. I'm already over. Sorry, Jeremy. It would be neat to design training around risks so that it's embedded in how they. So it's not just about filling in numbers and managing bureaucracy or anything like that, but it's also sort of this risk-based, risk-grounded training and materials. The team needs to be trained to recognize things related to privacy and security so that it's a team effort and not just this one person who has that knowledge. And that, you know, I think there's something to this leadership models and that if you can train one person to be a very good leader and then train other people, that may be able, you may be able to sort of optimize how you train people to do this stuff. Anyway, that's it. Sorry to go over.
I think it's worth noting that if the TSA ran elections, the result of that would be to ban Italian food on election.
So, Joe, that's really, really fascinating. And I'm just one thing that occurs to me when you talk about sort of the kinds of problems you noticed when you knew what the rules were and were watching. Is there any way to maybe produce more documentation of these procedures for the public so that people, while they're waiting to vote, could also be watching for perhaps something that's not correct that the poll workers aren't noticing and try to distribute this function of making sure procedures are being followed?
I think so. So I think you could make a list of 10 common problems in a jurisdiction to look out for, because they're often really related to the particular rules in that jurisdiction. But to be comprehensive, I don't want to go there, because that's, you know, there's just, like in California, for example, another weird conflict in the law is that the law says you have to allow the very first person to vote to see that there's an empty ballot box before you seal it and shut it and all that kind of stuff. And the way counties have interpreted this is a different part of the law that says show them that the counter says 000. And there was an individual sitting in the back of this room named Hari Hursti who showed with it was Hursti 1 or Hursti 2, that in certain voting systems, and I'm not saying they still do this, you could have negative votes preloaded and positive votes that would then cancel out as a 000 tally on the LCD screen. Anyway, so there's all these complicated things. I think it would be easy, especially with some expert direction in few states and jurisdictions, to create small lists of, look for this, you know, here's a critical point in which you want to make sure that this is caught.
Well, give voters something else to do while they're waiting in line, too.
Yeah, yeah.
As a poll worker, I hate that idea.
Dana, what's
up?
Yeah,
to Alex's point, it's like if you see something, say something.
If you see these 10 things, say something.
First, I want to congratulate you on this study. I wish that I had this myself. The things that you're talking about poll worker mental models of security totally line up with all the other research about usable security and how normal people model security and privacy in their own heads about all different kinds of other situations.
And we left that out of the literature review.
So it's not
post-reviewing myself here.
It's not surprising then that some poll workers are doing things that appear to be risky. They are rationalizing this, and they're doing the thing that they think is the best possible thing to do. But I wonder also if you saw in the course of Election Day more risky behavior or less respect for procedure toward the end of the day than you did at the beginning of the day? Anything like that? Decision fatigue or compliance budget issues?
There was fatigue, but it wasn't, I think once they get sort of an idea of here's the standard operating procedure for whatever this method is, that didn't tend to break down. The things that tend to happen were like, you know, people throwing objects across the room because they're so tired they don't want to walk across the room and stuff like that, and breaking a piece of equipment in the process, right?
Yeah.
And that made it left out of our paper. But so I didn't see decision fatigue, like sort of procedural fatigue. We definitely just saw normal fatigue. Like, you know, it's really hard to add up numbers after 10, 12 hours,
yeah.
16 hours. But
yeah.
We didn't see that.
Interesting.
It'd be neat. I would love to have a team of observers that we could do a more systematic, you know, quantitative observation in a given jurisdiction, because it would just be, especially after something like this where we know at least in a few places what to look for, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
But
it
would be hard to fund. I mean, it's always hard to fund voting stuff, but anyway.
Yes. Thanks.
Joe, you didn't observe a voter ID state or voter ID procedures, did you?
Yeah, one of our vignettes is actually about someone walks up to you. We didn't observe it. So we did, in the sense that a lot of people will walk up and just give their ID to the poll worker. And so we had this whole vignette, and I forget the exact wording. It was, a voter walks up to you and gives you their ID. What are some of the issues involved with that? And only a few people ever thought of, well, that's not required and stuff like that. But what the interesting thing we did see is that, especially in the more racially diverse polling place, was that inevitably, I can't find your name, how do you spell it, whatever, that would be solved by someone pulling out something where the name was written down as it was on something else. And that's great. You know, I mean, you don't have to have, you know, something that sort of is a picture ID to do that. You just need to, you could even write it down yourself for them to do that. But so it's not a very sexy part of our paper, but we observed it. It's just, no one even complained about it. You know, no one said, we had a GOP observer who was saying, hey, every single one of these people should be ID'd.
So a common experience for me in the last few years as a poll worker, without fail, somebody during the day will hand me a driver's license, and I say, sorry, we don't need that.
Exactly.
And then the guy gets mad at me. The whole point of handing me the ID was to confront me on the issue that I don't need.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
Every time somebody does that.
Interesting. Man, I want to observe your point, please. Thanks, guys.